The museum's exhibit on ancient Egypt was the thing of legends for my small hometown. Not for the hieroglyphics on the walls or the history of the Great Pyramids, but because they had a real-life mummy. The sarcophagus was situated in the center of a small room painted a deep blue, with bronze-gold hieroglyphics painted in a way to simulate the interior of a real crypt. The recessed lights in the ceilings all pointed towards a figure in the center, a mummified corpse that lay directly beneath the sarcophagus lid that was suspended to show the grisly contents. One hand was slightly unwrapped, and as I found myself once again back in that cool, air-conditioned room, I could have sworn I saw the fingers move. I looked around, but it was a Wednesday afternoon and I realized I was alone in the exhibit hall. I looked back at the fully wrapped figure, sure that my eyes had played a trick on me, when the hand moved, visibly. I gasped, and then the head, wrapped in black bandages, turned towards me. I screamed as the mummy sat up and swung the sarcophagus lid towards me, the heavy stone crashing through the glass. I heard footsteps growing closer as I crawled backwards into a corner, all exits blocked off by the ancient creature that was now up and shambling towards me. It ripped at its face, pulling away bandages and hacked, sending up a cloud of dust. It stepped closer and closer until it grabbed me in its bony grasp and said, "My name is Rick Kitagawa, and this is the Inner Monster Podcast." I grew up in Stockton, California, and in an attempt to get me interested in history, my mom would occasionally take me to the Hagen Museum, and like in the story, the Hagen Museum had a mummy. I thought this was one of the coolest things ever as a little kid, and also super creepy. It was quite possibly one of my earliest experiences with death, and while researching the show, I was actually a bit sad to hear that almost a decade ago, the museum's 60-some year loan of the mummy was up, and it left the Hagen Museum and returned to its owner, the Legion of Honor Museum in my second hometown of San Francisco. A part of me wants to think that the mummy is following me, but it hasn't yet caught up to me in Southern California. But I guess I can always keep my fingers crossed. Mummies, while seeming foreign and exotic, are really the only way that ancient Egyptians honored their dead. From as early as 2800 BCE, mummification was the standard way of dealing with a dead body. Interestingly enough, I imagine that this was only reserved for those of high status, but while the pharaohs and holy men were given the full treatment of having most of their organs removed and mummified separately, even the layperson would get bandaged up and soaked in natron, a water-absorbing, bacteria-killing natural mix of soda ash and baking soda, and then, once dried, returned to the family. Interestingly enough, the oldest culture known to mummify their dead actually is not the Egyptians. 2,000 years prior in Chile, the Chinchorro people were already processing their dead via reconstruction. They would remove all the soft tissue and sort of create a fake body around the skeleton using grasses, oils, mud, animal hair, and white ash to sort of recreate the person's likeness before painting it all with black manganese. Regardless, the exotification of the Egyptian mummies gave birth to the mummy genre in horror, with a theme of fetishization and sexualization of female mummies in the early 19th century media. This gave way, fortunately, to the monsterization of mummies in 1932's The Mummy, which cemented the mummy as part of Universal's canon of famous monsters. But what I wanted to talk about most about mummies was the fact that for a long time, people would use ground-up mummies as medicine. That's right, people would take mummified corpses and turn them into powder for human consumption. I could go into much more detail on this slightly horrific piece of history, but what I wanted to get at is the notion that incredibly important, special people in life might find their bodies being ground up and consumed by strangers decades or even centuries later. And it is this fleeting notion of specialness that I want to dive into today. We are all, in some ways, living paradoxes when it comes to specialness. With one perspective, we're all unique, unreplicable individuals. And with another, we're insignificant beings in the vastness of the universe that are 99% similar to each other, if we're looking at it from a genetic material lens. That said, in that tiny percentage point, vast differences, compounded by the vastly different human experience of our culture, language, social structure, geographical region, and a bunch of other factors, creates an infinitely similar yet individual experience for all of us. And so it's this balance between specialness and insignificance that we must walk as humans, acknowledging that we're basically the same as the next person, but also completely unique and special. However, the fact that these two seemingly opposite characteristics are both true allow us the opportunity to then use whichever is most helpful at any given time to find success, whatever that means for us, in our own lives. We need to remember that we're special enough to show up and add our unique voice to the mix. Our voice, while individually small, does in fact matter, and we need to keep that in mind so we continually show up on the page, do the work, ship the project, and contribute to a thriving society. On the flip side, we need to remember that we are insignificant enough not to let setbacks and failure stop us from showing up. Remembering that if we mess up, the universe isn't going to collapse helps keep us humble, but also takes the pressure off needing to be perfect. And I know that snowflake is commonly used as an insult these days, but it might actually be a great description for all of us. To be clear, snowflake is used when attacking someone's fragility when they're not willing to take criticism. And interesting that most people who use this as an insult end up being fairly fragile themselves, but that is not my point. My point is that snowflake might be the perfect metaphor to describe all of humanity. After all, like snowflakes, we're unique and also generally fragile. At the same time, alone, we're fairly insignificant, but together in large quantities, we are a force to be reckoned with. So perhaps we should rethink what it means to be a snowflake and focus less on being resilient to criticism and more on how we can enroll others in the future that we hope to create. After all, no change to society, no product launches, no race won is a product of a single person's labor. So if we ever want to create anything, we literally need to enroll others in our vision. Whether that's a book, a Kickstarter campaign, or even convincing your friends where to meet for dinner, it takes a village to make things happen. This actually carries over back to the snowflake metaphor. After all, a single snowflake on its own melts quickly, is easily crushed, and can be moved with nothing more than a single breath. But as a collective, snowflakes can become a snowstorm that will shut down cities, destroy technology and infrastructure, and freeze people to death. So perhaps being special isn't about being especially talented or skilled at something. In today's era of trust-centered leadership, being special just might be the willingness to go out there and make assertions to enroll people in the change you seek to make. It's embracing the fact that true leadership is really about power with others, not power over others. It's the culture shift that the book New Power talks about, one that harnesses the power of collaboration and co-creation to build movements. I think the secret to making change is to embrace your specialness. First, figure out what gift only you can offer. Second, It's now about building the skills needed to earn the trust of others to build a tribe of committed, dedicated co-conspirators, collaborators, and superfans. Because after all, teamwork makes the dream work. And together with this band that you've built, fostered, and grown, you'll find that your specialness, that unique mix of both your lived experience with that less than 1% of DNA difference, can truly be a gift to the world. So what special gift are you looking to share? That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Inner Monster podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to check out all of our other episodes wherever you get your podcasts or visit innermonsterpodcast.com. And if you feel so inclined, please spread the word and share this with a friend, or leave a review, or subscribe to get the podcast each week, every Inner Monster Monday. And now, a quick word from our sponsors. The future is now here, both in the metaphysical sense as well as the book sense. The new book I co-authored, The Future is Trust, Embracing the Era of Trust-Centered Leadership, is now available in both ebook and paperback formats on Amazon and most places where books are sold online. So go get your copy. I'm super excited to bring this reimagination of what a leadership book can be, and whether you prefer a clean, text-centric ebook or the full-color photo print edition, my co-author and I have been intentional in cutting out the fluff to bring you a book full of actionable and practical insights that will help you build the trust needed to help your organization thrive and build a resilient culture. All killer, no filler, as Sum 41 would say. So if you haven't got your copy yet, visit thefutureistrust.com to pick one up today. And if you have already got your copy, I would be so grateful for an honest review on Amazon. Trust is better together, so I sincerely hope you will join us in our quest to make the world a more trustworthy and trusted place, and pick up your copy of The Future is Trust today. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a monstrous day.